years afterward. There are situations when a person can withstand excruciating pain and agony, but everyone has a breaking point when something is so horrible or unbearable that the mind is deadened and refuses to control the body. Bravery and cowardice are not involved because these are instinctive actions. For me, spiders were unbearable. The sight or thought of them induced terror and panic. I was a child again, trapped within the family dumbwaiter shaft, crawling with spiders. The faint illumination from the light I left burning showed the outline of the spider as it cleared itself from the wetness of my faceplate. I clawed at my faceplate, trying to grab the damn thing, forgetting in my panic that I could not reach it. I also thought of flooding the inside of my helmet with water to drown it, but quickly realized that it would rush to my face again to escape the water. The thought that it could be poisonous made me shudder. I had seen black widows on the island. Oh God, help me, I prayed. But before I could think further, the demon crawled to the top of my helmet. Ed, why are you groaning? What's the matter with you? I could not answer. God damn it, answer me! Ben's booming voice jarred me back to reality. Oh God, Ben, there's a spider in my helmet. Get me the hell out of here. I turned and started through the stateroom. I tripped over an exposed beam, stumbled and fell spread eagle, dislodging the spider into my hair. My scalp prickled with fear. The spider traveled down to my forehead. Tracing its movements, I fought furiously against the panic. Slowly, the devil moved between my eyes and down the bridge of my nose. Its path of unseen terror left a gauzy trail of gossamer as it crawled across my cheek. I finally reached my breaking point. I heard a scream coming from above my head. I vaguely realized it came from me. I struggled to remain conscious. For a brief moment, I was a gibbering idiot. When I surfaced, my tenders frantically hauled me up the ladder, and I stumbled over to the dressing stool. "Hurry up and get his helmet off," said Ben. "Give him some air." Crouching in one of the top window ports was a non-poisonous cane spider. Moon grabbed a glove, reached into the helmet, and squashed it. I was still in shock, but when my senses returned, I turned to Moon. That goddamn spider really spoiled my day. I tried to make light of my experience, but from that day forward, I never pulled on another diving dress before turning it inside out to make sure it was free of any varmints. Naval Aviation. It was about the time we finished work on the Utah that word came that the Navy was soliciting applications from enlisted personnel for pilot training. As soon as the sampan reached the dock, I headed for the diving officer's office. I knocked on the door, and Haynes invited me in. I related my long-held desire to become an aviator and also described my many disappointments in trying to attain that goal. "Sir, I don't know if you have seen the notice requesting volunteers for the Naval Aviation Cadet Program, but I want to volunteer for it. This may be my last chance." Haynes released a puff of cigarette smoke and interrupted. "Maybe you were never meant to be a flyer. Maybe somebody is trying to tell you something. Think about it." I did not tell him I had been thinking about it for years. I just said I still wanted to try for it. Haynes laid his cigarette in the ashtray and looked me in the eye. "Go ahead and see my yeoman. Make out a request, and I'll recommend approval of it. I don't like losing you, Raymer. You are a valuable member of the diving crew." My request was subsequently approved by the commanding officer of the salvage unit. In a few days, I was ordered to report to Lieutenant John Crow at the Naval Air Station, Ford Island, for my physical and mental examinations. I fretted over being rusty in mathematics, but that worry proved to be groundless, as I passed all the tests with flying colors. Lieutenant Crow informed me that I should be receiving orders for flight training within a few weeks. Meanwhile, diving continued. The diving officer called me into his office the following morning and informed me that the crew would be diving on the Arizona after all. "It sounds like the powers that be are confused, sir. First we're going to raise the Arizona, then we aren't. What's next?" I know, Raymer. But this time around, the salvage work makes some sense, despite the fact that political considerations helped bring it about. Haynes explained that the officials of Honolulu requested that the U.S. Army provide them with additional anti-aircraft protection. Since neither the Army nor the Navy had any spare AA rifles available, the Navy Department offered to loan the Arizona's guns to the Army. The guns were scheduled for installation around Pearl Harbor and Honolulu. Chapter 4. USS Arizona. Removing the 5-inch AA guns. Despite the widespread damage to the first 200 feet of the bow section, the starboard side aft of No. 2 turret was largely undamaged in the area where 4 5-inch anti-aircraft guns were located. These rifles were accessible for salvage. We moved our 2 barges with the sea bag full of bottles dangling below over to the Arizona and made preparations to remove the 5-inchers. The guns were in carriages, and each was secured to the deck of the Arizona by 32 threaded studs and nuts. Each stud was 2 inches in diameter. At high tide, the nuts and studs were covered by 6 feet of water. Cameron was dressed and made the first dive in order to ascertain if the nuts could be removed by using an impact wrench. He reported that the starboard side deck was in good condition and that an impact wrench could be used. We borrowed a heavy-duty pneumatic impact wrench from the shipyard and started work to remove the guns. As each gun carriage was unbolted, the Marianne, a crane barge, came alongside. We rigged wire straps to the carriages, and they were hoisted aboard the barge and delivered to the yard ordnance shop for reconditioning. The guns were later distributed around Oahu for anti-aircraft protection. Lieutenant Haynes had promised us liberty as soon as we finished removing the 4 guns. He said recovery of the shells could wait until later, since they could be reconditioned much faster than the guns. After the last AA rifle was delivered on 27 February, we headed for the barracks that evening full of anticipation and plans for our first liberty the next day. Sleep did not come easily for most of us that night. First Liberty. Since our arrival in Pearl Harbor on 8 December, we had worked 14-hour days, 7 days a week. The stress and strain of the job was beginning to tell on us. Pearl Harbor offered no rest and recreation facilities. There was nowhere we could go and nothing we could do to recuperate from nerves rubbed raw from the strain of facing the hidden dangers within the ships. Being surrounded by filthy conditions was a debilitating experience to endure without respite. Divers and tenders were covered with oil and slime, while the stench of decaying bodies and the putrid smell of hydrogen sulfide gas permeated the water and air. Stories filtering back from sailors who had been granted leave much earlier did nothing to boost our morale. We needed the companionship of women and rest and relaxation badly. In addition, we still had an untouched sea bag full of bottles of 190-proof straight alcohol dangling under the diving barge, which we were sure would open the gates of the island and the arms of the girls of Honolulu. By popular demand, Mullen and I were selected to be the point men to ferret out the most promising companions, notify them of our alcohol cache, and arrange a party to celebrate the end of Prohibition, at least for a favored few of us. When I had been stationed in Pearl Harbor the previous year, I had consumed a delicious 24-ounce porterhouse steak at Ernie's Bar and Grill on Hotel Street. I remembered that not only was the food excellent, but that Ernie employed Portuguese girls as waitresses and bartenders, all of them buxom and fun-loving. I was sure they were the party girls we were looking for. All of us were in a happy mood as we pulled on our immaculate white uniforms. The garments looked even whiter against our deep island tans. Andrew and Martin headed for Waikiki. They said they wanted to spend time on the famous beach and visit a zoo they had heard about. Andy also planned to shop for a present for Enid. "Jesus, Andy," Ben teased, "you're planning one hell of an exciting and strenuous day. Are you sure you'll be able to work tomorrow? What you really need is a good lay. You come along with me, and I'll show you how it's done." He chuckled wickedly. "You go your way and I'll go mine, Ben," Andy said as he slammed the barracks door. Ben, Bill, Cameron, and Jimmy crowded into a cab outside the main gate of the receiving station. Ben had informed anyone who would listen that he knew the best cat house in all of Honolulu. The 4 divers headed for the nearest cat house on Hotel Street, only to find out they had a 2-hour wait in a line of white and khaki uniforms that stretched for 3 city blocks. Tony, always the loner, decided to lose himself in one of the many all-day movie theaters in Honolulu, then try to find a good Italian restaurant and maybe finish the day with a visit to one of the electric massage parlors that dotted Hotel Street. He heard they had been started by the Japanese, but had been taken over by enterprising Chinese and made even more exhilarating. He was not inclined to stand in line for any prostitute. "If you had to pay for it, forget it," he declared. Later in the day, Moon and I carried the required helmets and gas masks over our shoulders and passed through the main gate of Pearl Harbor. The gate guards made no move to inspect the masks, so I felt confident that when the time came to transport the alcohol out of the base, we would have no trouble. We lined up to wait for a 9-passenger taxicab into town. It was driven by an enormous brown Hawaiian who spoke fractured Kanaka Pidgin. "Wherefore you go?" he asked, when we crowded into the cab, a hollow question when everyone knew the Pearl Harbor taxis had only one route, directly to the Army-Navy YMCA in Honolulu and back to the station. They never picked up passengers or dropped them off at any other location. As the ancient taxi chugged past Ala Park and passed over the narrow Nuuanu Stream Bridge, the stench of River and Hotel Streets assailed our nostrils. "Time to hold your noses, guys," I said, grimacing. The stink permeated the area and was unlike any other I had ever smelled. Old China hands claimed it reminded them of the odors around the waterfronts of Shanghai and Hong Kong. The best theory was that it came from the carcasses of animals and fish entrails hanging in the open-air butcher shops along the streets. The cab moved slowly past the many dilapidated ancient two-story buildings, jammed together, each carrying a different name. New Senator Hotel, Ritz, Anchor, service rooms, and so on. They all had one thing in common. They were part of Honolulu's red light district. By 10 a.m., the lines of patrons stretched 4 blocks down the street and disappeared around the corner. The cab inched its way up the narrow, bustling North Hotel Street to the Army-Navy YMCA. The Y was set back from the street, and its best feature was a beautiful courtyard in the front that was planted with majestic palm trees. It was an inviting sanctuary, but it was avoided by the divers who disdained to enter its doors even to make a phone call. They claimed it was only for the use of guys who were lonely or homesick or teetotalers with nothing better to do on Liberty. He-Man divers looked for booze and women, not books, playing cards, or letter-writing material. Across the street was the notorious Black Cat Cafe. It was housed in an old wooden frame building that had been painted at one time. Hawaiian weather had taken its toll, and the paint was checked and peeling. As with most other businesses along North Hotel Street, the Black Cat's front was open to the street. Sailors often used it as a meeting place because everyone knew its location. However, only the unwary stopped for a drink. It was well known as a clip joint to be avoided like the plague. When we arrived at the Y, my mouth was watering in anticipation of the succulent steak I planned to eat at Ernie's. Apparently, Moon's appetite was focused on things other than food. "I'll walk down to Ernie's with you, buddy, but then I think I'll mosey down to the service rooms and see if any of the old pre-war hookers are still around. It's been a year since I was there, but maybe I'll see a familiar face. Sure you don't want to join me?" "No thanks." Moon visits Honolulu's fairest. As Mullen walked away down the street, he yelled back, "I'll meet you at Ernie's in a couple of hours. By that time, I'll be counting on you to have the gals all lined up for a luau on the beach next week." "Sure, sure," I replied, thinking that standing in a long line in the hot Hawaiian sun to visit a whorehouse was not my idea of a fun liberty. I didn't blame the other guys for doing it, but it wasn't for me. My reverie was cut short as a cacophony of honking horns and other street noises blasted my ears. I looked down narrow Hotel Street, made narrower by cars parked on both sides of the street, leaving one lane of traffic down the middle. Hundreds of pedestrians crowded the narrow sidewalks, pushing and shoving in their haste to reach their destinations. Traffic was stopped as soldiers and sailors crossed the street to reach the trashy attractions lining the sidewalks. Souvenir shops selling junk, shooting galleries whose pretty attendants egged on the gullible to prove their marksmanship, photo studios with girls in hula skirts, eager to pose for a picture to send home. sleazy bars. Mom and Pop Simon, pork and noodle shops, one of the few worthwhile businesses on the street. Barber shops featuring Oriental girl barbers. Electric massage parlors with signs depicting lightning bolts. And finally, Ernie's, the only bar and grill in the area that employed Portuguese women and served delicious 24-ounce steaks at a reasonable price. I saw a long line of servicemen waiting to enter Ernie's, so I decided to get a haircut at one of the shops that employed lady barbers to kill some time before Moon returned. Afterward, I returned to the bar and grill and was happy to see the line was much shorter. I was finally motioned to a booth. After gorging myself on steak and French fries, I looked up and saw Moon frantically waving his arms at me. I wormed my way out of the booth and approached Ernie, who was perched in his usual position atop a high-backed stool. "Hey, Ernie, see the sailor with the black hair about 10th in line? He's with me. How about letting him in? He'll be sharing my booth." Ernie motioned Moon to the head of the line amidst much grumbling and booing from the men ahead of him. The waitress took his order, and we settled in to wait for it. "Well, did you get your ashes hauled?" I said. "Yeah, I think so. It's kind of hard to tell when you're in and out as fast as I was. Let me tell you, friend, things are sure different from the way they were last year." "I can imagine." "No, you can't. Not till you've been there and seen it with your own eyes." I'd have to be pretty hard up to take on a prostitute under the present circumstances. Believe me, buddy, I was hard up. Moon began by saying that war breeds many ironies, and perhaps one of the biggest was that while the general population of Honolulu was losing many of their civil liberties, the prostitutes of Honolulu were being liberated. For the general public, under U.S. Army martial law, full prohibition was in effect. Most bathing beaches were closed to swimming, with barbed wire strung across the sand. Stringent blackout rules were mandated, and a rigid 9 o'clock curfew was enforced. Before the attack on Pearl Harbor, prostitutes in the brothels off river and hotel streets had few, if any, rights. They were enslaved by the system, which decreed what they could do and when and where they could do it. There were many unwritten laws designed to keep them segregated from society. Not even the Negro slaves before the Emancipation Proclamation suffered greater deprivation of their freedom. The Honolulu prostitutes enjoyed only the rights the vice squad chose to allow them. They were nothing more than chattels to be bought and sold, their duties set forth by each individual madam until their contracts expired. There was no running away or escaping from the system. Escape routes from Oahu were carefully monitored by the island vice squad. The only transportation was the weekly sailing of the commercial steamships or the clipper flying boats. The girls were not allowed to leave one house to work in another unless both madams approved. The girls were subservient to the madams, completely at their mercy. More than one girl who tried to rebel against the system found herself at the business end of a rubber truncheon, swung by a vice squad officer. She was never hit or jabbed in the face, arms, or legs, because that would leave bruises and damage the appearance of the merchandise. Instead, she was beaten across the buttocks or stomach, painful but undetectable. Moon continued to reminisce about his days in pre-war Honolulu when he and a buddy went ashore and discovered the service rooms. He soon learned that cat houses around the world were pretty much the same. The customer entered the main bullpen, where the girls were assembled. There was always a jukebox blaring out the current hits of the day. Sometimes the girls danced with a prospective customer if the music was slow and dreamy. The girls paraded by the customer and by word and deed apprised him of their wares. He was allowed to pat the merchandise, even pinch it gently to test for authenticity. Then the customer usually bought one or two drinks for himself and a look-alike drink for the girl of his choice. Madams did not want the girls drinking alcohol during working hours, since this could impair their work and deprive the madam of her revenue. After a few drinks to bolster his courage, the customer and his girl retired to a private room. After a reasonable period of time, not too long to seem unrealistic, or too short to be embarrassing, the customer came out with a smile on his face and exited unhurriedly. Moon said he soon found out the war and 2 million soldiers, sailors, and marines who passed through the islands had changed the procedures. Under the U.S. Army's control, Honolulu prostitutes were emancipated to a degree never thought possible. Under martial law, they were largely protected from the Honolulu Vice Squad. They could live away from the houses if they desired, and they were free to visit any place they could afford. This change was mandated because of the huge influx of military men who needed to be serviced. Honolulu whorehouses were modernized to serve the largest number of customers in the shortest space of time, so that the fighting men would be taken care of promptly and efficiently. Along with this degree of freedom, the prostitutes had to agree to sacrifice more for the war effort by increasing their production from a pre-war output of 10 to 15 tricks per day to a new quota of more than 100 tricks per day. The prospect of this new plan had most of the girls clutching their crotches in disbelief and dismay. But rising to the occasion and displaying all the zeal and trappings that made Hawaii great, the girls set a schedule of work that had never been attained before. By allowing an average of 3 minutes per trick, an enterprising prostitute could rack up her quota in 5 or 6 hours. This would net her about $300 a day after paying the madam her cut. By assuming a 22-day work month, a hard-working girl could earn $70,000 or $80,000 a year tax-free. Also, every whore in Honolulu was guaranteed a full day's work for as long as her stamina held up. The long lines of fighting men patiently waiting their turns was assurance of this. The line started forming shortly after 7 a.m. when liberty began, and as the day wore on, the lines grew longer and longer and tempers grew shorter and shorter. The men at the end of the lines became edgy and concerned that they would not gain entrance to the house before their liberty expired at 5 p.m. This would mean 5 long days before they could come ashore again, if in fact they were not shipped out in the meantime. Only the vigilance of the military police kept fights from erupting. Moon's order arrived, and he began devouring great chunks of rare beef. "So, tell me about your day with the ladies of the night, or morning, as it happens to be." In between bites of steak, Moon continued on with his favorite subject. He said it had taken him 2 hours to move up to the front entrance of the service rooms. When he reached the security door, an enormous Kanaka man opened it and grunted, 10 mo. Moon was one of the 10 admitted. He said the aroma inside reminded him of a men's locker room. The smell was a combination of disinfectants, sweat, bath powder, and tobacco smoke. He said he could recognize the area as the old bullpen, but it had undergone some big changes. What had once been a relaxed, comfortable, uncrowded reception room now resembled Grand Central Station. The bullpen had been converted into a long passageway lined with doors covered with half-opened curtains. Inside the doors were small cubicles not more than 10 feet square. Each room contained a rattan chair, a bed, and on the floor a lahala mat. In one corner behind a screen was a shelf with the tools of the trade, douchebag, towels, soap, and bath powder. A huge Kanaka woman told him to point out the girl of his choice as the hurrying forms darted in and out of the curtained rooms. He said he had no idea who to select because none of the pre-war girls were around anymore. Neither could he describe the type and color of the wearing apparel of his choice because the girls were wearing none. He finally told the woman he would take the blonde with big boobs in number 4. Once he made his selection, an Oriental mama-san herded him into the tiny room and told him he had 3 minutes to complete the sex act. She urged him to undress chop-chop and get ready for the arrival of Missy FF. Moon paused. Can you believe the nerve of those broads giving a guy 3 measly minutes? Well, how is Missy going to perform her 100 tricks a day if she has to wait around for a bunch of slowpokes like you? I laughed. If this keeps up, wham bam, thank you, ma'am, will become a more popular battle cry than praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, said Moon. We meet the babes. Moon changed the subject as he gazed about the room, picking out the feminine figures tending bar and waiting on the many tables. Ooh-wee! Those are some fine-looking ladies. Old Ernie is a lucky guy to have 'em. I glanced over at the door where Ernie still sat on his stool, regulating the number of military who could enter his establishment. Ernie was a brawny, overweight Portuguese, nearing 50, who rarely smiled but occasionally pulled his heavy lips into a grimace that served as a substitute. His expression was one of constant concern for the potentially explosive situation that was present at his restaurant. Far too many hungry, love-starved men were lusting after the few available girls. I agreed that Ernie was a lucky fellow. There wasn't another cafe in the street that had a line waiting to get in, and I was sure it wasn't just the good food. We watched as one of the girls paused to take a rest. She stood with an elbow hooked over the bar behind her, her rich body indolently curved. The men at the tables whistled, cheered, and stomped as she laughed, tossed her head, and headed for the kitchen. "Wait till you've been in here a while and listen to these gals. They're a pretty independent bunch. They will tell a customer off in no uncertain terms if he gives them any kind of guff, and that goes for Ernie, too. Just before you came in, I heard the redhead yell over to him, 'Up yours with a broomstick, Ern.'" We lit up cigarettes as we watched the girls strut their stuff. The women working the bar were more attractive than the waitresses. I had my eye on the red-headed bartender, Hattie. She was well-built, with eyes that flashed darkly in her olive-skinned face. She smiled seductively as she wiggled her hips and flirted outrageously with the customers, obviously enjoying her work. I'm sure she was not worried about the consequences of her actions, because liberty expired for her admirers at 5 p.m., well before she and her friends cleaned the restaurant and went home. Mullen expressed some doubts about our chances of talking these Portuguese dollies into going out with us, even if we supplied the booze. While I had my doubts too, I was not about to admit it, at least not until we had given it the old college try. I jabbed a finger at the tall bartender, whose curly black hair was piled high on top of her head. As she leaned forward, the blue cloth of her blouse was strained tight against her ample chest. We heard her repeat an order in a rather coarse, husky voice, using the island pidgin English. "I think that gal is leader of the girls. She seems to have the most to say. Her name is Margaret. I think if we can convince her, the others will go along." The island Portuguese community were direct descendants of sailors, fishermen, and explorers who had come early to Hawaii and made it their home. Many of them still spoke the language, though it had been many years since they thought of Portugal as their mother country. They tended to live and congregate among their own, finding it more comfortable, as many of the island minorities did, to mingle with the people who looked and behaved most like themselves. I knew these girls had heard every line in the book. Their contact with servicemen and their own raucous people had helped them develop a vocabulary that matched Ben Apple's. I knew we had to come up with a good story, or they would laugh us out of Ernie's and shower us with a string of obscenities that would make a madam blush. Our waitress came by and cleared the table. She was short, with sturdy brown legs, a big rear end, and grapefruit-sized breasts. She asked us if we wanted anything else. "Yeah," Moon said. "What's your name?" "Katie," she snapped, "if it's any of your business." Moon asked her to tell Margaret we had some very important information that would be of great interest to her and her girlfriends. Katie walked away and then turned and gave us a long, questioning look. Then she walked to the bar and whispered in Margaret's ear, jerking her thumb in our direction. A few minutes later, Margaret left the bar and slammed through the swinging doors to the kitchen. We finished our coffee as Margaret entered the room again and headed for our booth. "What do you two bubbleheads want with Katie?" she asked, noting the diving insignias on our arms. "We have a proposition we know you'll be interested in," I began. Margaret raised a plump hand in a gesture of rejection. "Stop right there. I know what you're interested in, what every guy who comes in here is interested in." "Look, Margaret, we want to invite you to a special party. Moon and I and four more of our buddies are planning a luau, Portuguese style." I emphasized the Portuguese. Her eyes widened and she raised her black eyebrows. "Where did you hear the expression luau, Portuguese style?" "I was here last year when I came in with the fleet, and I overheard you and your friends talking about one of your outings." "Then you must know that you need one special ingredient for that kind of party, and martial law has snatched it off the market. No booze, no luau." We could hardly believe our ears. This was exactly what we wanted to hear. "That's where we come in," Moon chirped, a wide, happy grin crossing his face. "We wouldn't think of inviting you ladies to a party without providing the liquor. We've got enough for a luau every night of the week." Margaret narrowed her eyes with a look of suspicion. You wouldn't snow old Margaret, would you? Hell no, it's true. We've got it, and we want to share it with you and your girlfriends. If you could round up some canned pineapple juice, Ed can make some of his famous Sneaky Pete punch, and we can plan a party Sunday after next. What do you say? Suddenly, the woman's skepticism turned to interest. Well, maybe we could work something out, she said slowly. I could sure use some fun. Let me kick it around with some of the girls. I'll be back. We could hardly contain ourselves. We congratulated each other profusely, agreeing we were a couple of irresistible gobs, when we noticed Ernie glowering at us. We had occupied the booth an overly long time. We had also commanded special attention from his head bartender, and he looked like he was ready to show us the door. But nothing short of dynamite could have budged us from that spot until Margaret returned and gave us definite word that the girls would cooperate. When she returned, she said that Hattie, the red-headed bartender, was willing, and Katie, our waitress, would go, and she was sure she could find enough party girls to satisfy all six divers. We made plans to meet in 2 weeks. I figured we could remove the 5-inch shells from the Arizona within that time frame and wangle another Liberty. Hey, kiddo, you never said where you were getting the booze. Then she put her hands over her ears and shook her head. Never mind, don't tell me. I don't care as long as you get it. And listen, you two, this better not be some kind of joke. Margaret's going to be awfully mad if you show up empty-handed. She turned to march back to the bar, her ample hips swaying and stretching her blue skirt to its limits. The news of the upcoming party and our success in persuading the feminine guests was told in exaggerated detail as we gathered the divers around my bunk that evening. Everyone was excited by the prospect and demanded that Moon and I repeat over and over the description of each of the girls. Even Andy and Martin hung around and listened and were pleased that we'd had such luck. Shit! I want the one with the biggest, fattest butt, Ben shouted to no one in particular, as we disbanded and finally fell into bed after the first Liberty in 2 months ended happily. Removing 5-inch projectiles. Our crew returned to the Arizona Monday morning, anxious to tackle the job of removing the 5-inch anti-aircraft shells from the after magazine, unaware of the problems awaiting us. The removal of the 5-inch projectiles from the magazines proved to be a taxing and difficult job. It was decided that the fastest and safest way to gain entrance to the magazines was to cut holes directly through the decks into the top of the magazine spaces. A cargo net could then be lowered straight down into the magazine, and divers could load the shells into it. The net would be hoisted by a crane to topside. We began cutting the hole between numbers 3 and 4 turrets. Cutting the 10-foot square holes through the first few decks went along fairly smoothly, although some difficulty was experienced burning through the heavy steel deck beams with the arc oxygen cutting torch. Bronco Bill was the first diver to try his hand. Juice on, came the command from Rush. We heard popping sounds and then some mumbled profanity. Juice off, topside. There's something wrong with this damn cutting torch. It won't cut through the deck. There's probably nothing wrong with the torch, I said. It's probably the cork insulation on the overhead of the magazine that won't allow the molten slag to fall through. We'll jack up the oxygen pressure to about 150 pounds and see if that will blow the slag through. After a few moments, we heard from Bill. It's working fine now. I'm getting through okay. Suddenly, there was the muffled sound of an explosion, and the water rippled and bubbled over the hole that had been cut in the deck. Moon shouted down on the telephone. Bill, are you all right? What's happened? No answer was forthcoming, and Bill's diving line seemed to be hung up, preventing us from pulling him up. Get me dressed, I shouted. I'm going down. The tenders were just fastening my helmet when Rush's dazed voice came over the phone. Where am I? The deck came up in my face and cold-cocked me. In a calm voice, Moon told him his lines were fouled, to clear them, and we would bring him aboard. We brought Rush aboard and undressed him. The moment his helmet was removed, he looked around with a stupefied gaze. He had suffered an angry cut on his chin that was bleeding profusely. Martin said, "We'd better get some pressure against that cut. Use this handkerchief. I don't want you to bleed to death. Bill held the bald handkerchief against his chin as we questioned him about the explosion. I don't know what caused it, he exclaimed, but no bucking bull ever kicked me that hard. The explosion halted diving operations for the next few days. After consulting the salvage experts, it was decided that the most probable cause of the explosion was a mixture of fuel oil fumes and unburned oxygen from the torch, which formed a gas pocket on the overhead and then exploded when it was touched off by the molten slag or spark from the torch. There seemed to be no solution to the problem except to reduce the severity of the explosions by cutting a few feet at a time, then wait for the gas pocket to bleed off through the cut made by the torch. This procedure worked fairly successfully in preventing another major explosion, but minor explosions continued to plague us. Ultimately, we decided to continue cutting into the magazine. A foam rubber strip was fitted over the lip of the metal breastplate to partially protect the diver's lip and chin from being cut when an explosion occurred. Andy was the man up for the first dive after Bill's experience. Hey, Andy, Ben laughed. Let's see if our farm boy can take it on the chin. Andy managed a nervous smile. Don't worry about me, Ben. I don't mind making the first dive, unless you insist on doing it. No thanks, Sonny. I'll wait my turn. You can be the guinea pig. I told Andy to remember to pull his suit bib up with his teeth and rest his chin against the foam rubber padding before he started cutting. Then he slowly descended into the total blackness of the interior of the Arizona, recovered the torch Rush had left behind, and began the job. Everybody waited and watched. This dive would tell us what we would have to contend with while this job was in operation. After a few minutes, small rumblings could be heard over the topside phone. I called down to Andy to stop cutting for a while and let the gas bubble bleed off. But before I could finish the message, a loud warrumph reached our ears, and Andy came popping to the surface spread eagle. Take in his slack, Tony, I shouted. Let's get him over to the ladder and see how he is. We all gathered at the ladder, and Moon opened his faceplate. How you doing, partner? Moon asked worriedly. I think I'm okay. Kind of shaken up, I guess. This is not exactly the way I like to surface, though. He told us the bib and foam pad seemed to work. The breastplate had not cut him as it had Bill. Then he asked to be taken over to the hole. I'll drop back down and see if I can finish the job. There's only about 8 more feet to cut. Bill and Ben looked at each other, raising their eyebrows in surprise. Moon closed the faceplate, and Andy lowered himself once more into the access hole. By God, Raggedy Andy's got more guts than I gave him credit for, Ben said, in uncharacteristic admiration. Being down there not knowing when the blow-up is coming has got to scare the hell out of a guy. Andy's obvious courage came as a surprise to us. He was a reserved man, and we had no idea he possessed such inner strength and resolve. He stood 5 feet 10 inches with a lean frame and muscled arms that had forked many a bale of hay. He had bright orange hair that was so unruly he kept it sheared almost to the scalp. He didn't smoke or drink, and he saved every cent of his pay so that he and his girlfriend Enid could be married someday. All of the divers except Cameron managed to exhibit the kind of physical courage necessary to overcome the terror of the frequent underwater blasts. The nerves in our bodies readied themselves for the inevitable explosion, and just as the tension was relaxed, another shattering blast would occur. By the end of a 4-hour dive, we were physically and mentally spent. When it was Cameron's turn to dive, he developed various ailments, an ear problem, a stomach ache, or a strained back muscle. His acting was convincing enough to satisfy the doctors as they placed him on light duty. But after all the holes had been cut through the tops of the magazines, all the mysterious aches and pains disappeared, and he became the healthy, chattering Cameron of old. Cameron was a medium-sized man, wiry, but stronger than he appeared. He moved in quick, nervous motions and seemed almost uncomfortable in his lean body. Coarse blonde hair framed his long sun-browned face, sharp-pointed chin, and hawkish nose. His mouth was a narrow line, the lips tight and thin. He was a Texan through and through, and though he had been a runt as a kid, he told us he had taken up wrestling in high school to add muscle to his frame. Once the opening was cut in the top of the 5-inch magazine, we began loading hundreds of rounds of shells into the lowered cargo nets. Then the shells were delivered to Westlock Ammunition Depot. Later, they were reconditioned and delivered to the Army for reissue. After lights out that night, I lay in my bunk, eyes open, thinking about the day's events. Andy's courage made an indelible impression on me. I tried to remember the definition of courage my father had given me many years ago when I was a teenager. They were meaningless words at the time, a time when I thought I knew everything but knew little. My father's words finally came flashing back. Moral courage compels truthfulness, makes a dependable quality, and gives a man the courage of his convictions. Whereas physical courage is an unnatural thing and exists only when a person's character is strong enough to overcome the fear instinct sufficiently to prevent its taking charge. Ben finds a bomb. The following Monday, we finished removing the shells from the magazine. Our next assignment was to explore and survey the damaged areas between frames 78 and 90 on the second deck of the Arizona. Ben was the designated diver. He was dressed and waiting to don his helmet when suddenly Bill yelled to all of us to come and look at something on the port side. We watched while tugs pushed and shoved the Nevada into dry dock. "What a great sight," I remarked. "One down and five more to go." The successful raising of the Nevada was made even sweeter when I recalled the skepticism voiced by Admiral Chester W. Nimitz and others who had thought her salvage impossible. Apple's rough voice brought us all back to the present. "Damn it, guys. Either get me in the water or undress me. I'm hot as hell." Tony led him over to the ladder, and he lowered himself to the main deck. Soon after he had reported that he was at the hatch and was undogging it, his tone of voice changed to a roar. "Ouch! God damn it! I fell into a hole in the deck and my leg's caught. I can't get up." Apple managed to extricate himself and discovered that the hole must have been made by a bomb. Because there was no apparent damage in the vicinity, we assumed it had not exploded. He traced the path of the bomb through two more decks and found it in the walk-in meat freezer under hanging sides of beef. He reported that the shell-slash-bomb felt similar to the one I found earlier in the Arizona General Workshop. I told him to bring the shell to the surface. Ben rolled the 2,000-pound shell out of the freezer, and we used a chainfall to lift it aboard the diving barge. It was a 15-inch shell that at one time had been used by old U.S. coastal guns, long since obsolete. The U.S. imprint was clearly visible, stamped into the base of the shell. Stabilizing fins had been welded to its base in order to give it the characteristics of a spiraling bomb. The old shell had been sold to Japan years before as scrap iron, and it had been returned to the USA with a vengeance. Ordnance experts came out, retrieved the shell, and sent it back to the Bureau of Ordnance in Washington, D.C. for analysis. As we watched them haul the bomb away, Martin remarked, "One thing's pretty clear. Japan must have been planning their attack on the U.S. for years, or they wouldn't have retained old 15-inch shells instead of melting them down for scrap." Portuguese Luau. Sunday finally arrived, the day we had looked forward to for so long, the day we were going to meet Hattie, Margaret, and her friends and have a real party. Expectations were intense as Bill, Ben, Jimmy, Moon, and I got dressed in our immaculate white uniforms. "Poor old Cameron. What a time to come down with cat fever," Moon said as he adjusted his black neckerchief. "Yeah, I guess he'll be in sick bay for at least 2 days. He spent plenty of time goofing off over there, but this time he was really suffering. I didn't think anything would keep him from going ashore today," Jimmy said. "Damn," Ben yelled as he labored over the shine on his black shoes. "I'm nervous as a friggin' whore in a cathedral." "The only thing I'm nervous about is getting past those jarheads at the gate. If they catch us with that alcohol, we'll be in bad trouble," said Jimmy. "Just pull the guts out of your gas mask and put the bottle inside like I'm doing. I said to him, as I worked busily with the mask. Hide the guts inside your locker so nobody finds them while we're gone. The Marine guards won't catch us. We watched them for a long time the other day, and they didn't check a single mask, Moon said. Raymer and I each have one bottle. Who wants to carry the other two? Give me one. Bill grabbed a pint. I got the other one, Ben said. If these broads decide to stand us up, I'll have a party all by myself. We passed through the gate with no trouble from the Marine sentries. We managed to find space in a cab headed for the Army-Navy YMCA, and I settled back, relieved at passing the first hurdle of the day. Geez, Moon, look at my hands. I scrubbed the skin off and still couldn't get the crap out from under my fingernails. The bunker oil gets into every pore and nothing takes it off. I examined my stained hands. I looked like a damn auto mechanic. Ass why hard? The cab driver piped up, using the strange pigeon wordage. What say? I don't understand, Moon said. Vass Island talk for life is tough for you folks, yeah? The cabbie replied. Yeah, it's tough sometimes when you're eating fuel oil all day. The cab wound its way through North Hotel Street. The perpetual lines of uniformed men waiting to get into the whorehouses were blocking some of the side streets and causing traffic to inch cautiously along. Over there get plenty grinds for the money, recommended the driver, nodding toward Ernie's. Yeah, said Moon, whatever. This island pigeon is weird as hell. We'll have to get Margaret to teach us. The taxi arrived at the Y, and we climbed out. I looked toward the Black Cat Cafe, hoping the girls had not changed their minds and backed out of the date. It had been 2 weeks since we had set things up with Margaret, and I had no way to reach her and confirm the party date. So I was relieved to see five of the girls grouped together, busily chattering among themselves, ignoring the whistles and wisecracks of the servicemen roaming the area. They were a bright spot on the street, their colorful sundresses and skirts contrasting with the white and khaki worn by the uniformed men. I see what I want, Ben said, the little chubby one with the big boobs and the round butt. Well, for Christ's sakes, let's don't stand here like a bunch of high school jerks. Let's get over there and meet these island queens, Bronco said impatiently. Margaret and Moon made the introductions. Margaret told us that one girl couldn't come, but things worked out well because Cameron couldn't make it either. I had already seen the red-haired Hattie and the short, stocky little Katie that Ben favored. Ben thought Katie looked like a series of circles, round little head covered with dark curls, round, enormous eyes, the O of her little mouth, and balloon-like breasts and buttocks. Josie was almost as tall as Margaret, with a finer bone structure but the same black eyes and hair. Her younger sister Mary completed the fivesome. All seemed to possess a hearty, indomitable vitality. Okay, handsome, Margaret turned to Moon. Where the hell's the booze you promised Margaret? We couldn't carry it in the open, he answered, sidling up to her. We've got it tucked away in our gas masks. Don't you worry about it, darling. Margaret made it clear by her remark that the girl's basic motivation for being there was the booze and not the company. Our looks and personalities were bound to charm the girls later on, I told myself, but at the moment, Cary Grant could not have scored with them without a bottle of hooch. We'll catch the bus that goes past the Kahala area, Margaret said. There's a beach called Hanama Bay. There's no barbed wire blocking it. We've been there for parties before the war, but nobody goes there anymore. Our little group of hardy revelers climbed aboard the bus marked Cocoa Head and headed out toward Waikiki. Moon and Margaret paired off naturally. I found a seat next to Hattie. I thought her short, bobbed hair showed a little individuality. Ben stuck with his original choice. Katie giggled incessantly at his colorful vocabulary. The other two men seemed perfectly content with Josie and Mary. The bus found its way up King Street. Margaret became the self-appointed tour guide as she proudly displayed her knowledge of the sights of historic Honolulu. See that big tower on your right down on the waterfront? That's the Aloha Tower. Back of you on the left is the Iolani Palace, built by King David Kalakaua in 1882. Her husky voice grew louder, presumably to capture the waning attention of her audience. "Across the street is the statue of our famous King Kamehameha," she shouted. The bus reached Ala Moana Boulevard and headed past Ala Moana Beach Park. Margaret was not getting the desired attention and apparently decided to use other tactics. "Hey, Hattie, remember when we had that big luau over on that beach and you and your boyfriend David Nuano got so drunk? You put on a hell of a show for us in the water, remember? He took so long diddling you, I thought he'd fainted or something." She laughed raucously. Her statements brought the attention she desired, especially from the girls. Hattie's black eyes flashed with anger, and I was sure Margaret realized she might have gone too far. The bus continued its journey to Kalakaua Avenue and turned right, taking us through the Waikiki District. "That pink hotel is the Royal Hawaiian, and next to it, the Moana Hotel. They have the biggest banyan tree in the world right in their courtyard. That's Waikiki Beach." She pointed to the beautiful aqua water splashing vividly white as it sent breakers onto the sand. "It don't look very exciting right now, but before the war, the surfers and war canoes were thick out there riding the waves." Margaret finished her role as tour guide and settled down in her seat next to Moon, teasing him about his long legs that were crowded awkwardly in the small bus space. For the rest of the bus ride around Diamond Head, the giggling and chattering continued unabated as girls and sailors became better acquainted. We traveled past the lovely beaches of Kahala, which were strung with barbed wire and patrolled by soldiers, and onto Kealoolu Road and the intersection of Kalani and Aole Highway. We finally swung right toward Cocoa Head and the end of the line. Margaret asked the bus driver to let us out on the bluffs above the bay, which was a few hundred yards below. The bus driver released his happy passengers and turned the bus around for its return trip to Honolulu. "What time does the last bus run?" Moon yelled to the driver. 4:30, the last one, brother," he shouted back. We walked down the steep pathway to the ocean below. No barbed wire ringed the sandy beach, and there was no sign of an army encampment. I was delighted. "Look at those breakers out beyond the reef. They're perfect for body surfing. Wish I'd brought my trunks." "Maybe we'll all go skinny dipping if we get drunk enough." Bill looked hopefully at Josie. "Yeah, and maybe you'll S if you eat regular," she shot back. Ben threw his head back and howled with laughter. "I couldn't have said it better if I tried." "Well, let's get with it," Hattie said. "Each of us brought a can of fruit juice, and I've got paper cups." "And here's the good stuff," I smiled triumphantly, pulling the pint bottle proudly out of its hiding place and raising it high above my head for everyone to admire. Everyone gave approving shouts except Hattie, who cried, "Uh-oh, what are we going to mix the punch in?" Moon stuck out his helmet. "We all had to carry one ashore along with the gas mask. We'll use a couple of these. We'll take out the lining, which leaves a nice little metal pot, ideal for mixing Sneaky Pete's," he laughed. "Yes, sir, the good old U.S. Navy thinks of everything. They want us boys in blue to be happy," Jimmy said. "Well, I won't be happy till one of you boys in blue takes those helmets down and rinses them out. I don't want hair oil floating around in the first good drink I've had in months," declared Margaret. The punch was put together with one can of grape juice, one of orange juice, another of pineapple juice, and one pint of 190-proof ethyl alcohol. The purplish, sweet, innocuous taste belied the devastating strength and potency of the drink. The combination of the hot Hawaiian sun and high alcohol content soon turned the party into a raucous, lively affair. The Portuguese luau was a smashing success, even though nobody went skinny dipping or got laid. But there were a few who staggered into the surf barefoot, with pant legs rolled or skirts held high, and there were some sloppy alcoholic kisses exchanged as the party broke up and we boarded the last bus into Honolulu. We thanked each other for one hell of a great time and tearfully expressed regrets that it had to end so soon. We vowed to meet again in 2 weeks for a repeat performance. We caught a taxi to Pearl Harbor, arriving an hour over leave, and were placed on report. Lieutenant Haynes was able to get our report slips for overleave canceled. He also issued a stern warning to us to get our tails back on time in the future. We poured ourselves into the barracks, seeking the comfort of our bunks. However, sleep came fitfully, interrupted by twitching seizures as the effects of the harsh alcohol wore off. "That hooch was pretty strong stuff," I said. "Sure was," Moon replied. "It did something to our voices. I'm so hoarse I sound like I've got a mouthful of gravel." "Yeah, for a minute, I thought you were Tallulah Bankhead," I laughed. "Well, go to sleep, Tallulah. We gotta work tomorrow," hissed a raspy voice down the row of bunks. Recovery of bodies. Within a few months after the attack, the Navy was pressured by Congress and the White House to bring up the bodies of the men who died on the Arizona. They felt it was imperative that they be given a proper burial. The Navy argued long and